Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com.
I'm a big believer. It's great. Things look pretty, but it's the effort that goes into baking that I think a lot of people appreciate.
Barbara Brozier is a journalist and a home baker, and she's my colleague at WFIU. We spend some time together off the clock making banana cookies and talking about where she developed her passion for baking. I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome. A sustainable agriculture hub is looking to keep the lights on with new streams of funding. That'll be a story from Harvest. Ranchers don't agree on how much the government should intervene in their sometimes unfair dealings with big meat companies. And then we meet an atypical resident of southern Indiana named Shadow. Before we get to all that, here's Mark Chilla with some food news.
A group of American ranchers say they want a corruption investigation into JBS, the world's largest meatpacking company, which has processing plants across the Midwest and Great Plains. JBS recently agreed to pay a $3 billion fine after revelations that executives were bribing government officials in Brazil. Bill Bullard of the American rancher group RCAF is asking the Trump administration for an investigation of the company's practices in the U.S., although there's no evidence of wrongdoing here. JBS first entered the U.S. market in 2007 with its purchase of a large beef and pork processor. After buying up smaller meat companies, it's now the world's largest producer of beef, chicken, and leather. In a new report, the Organic Trade Association says organic products now account for more than 5% of total U.S. food sales. That's $43 billion. Iowa State University sociologist Carmen Bain says the movement that once considered itself a bit of a counterculture has become almost conventionalized.
So I think there's a real tension among some producers, organic producers, consumers, advocacy groups, and so forth about what direction do they want organic to go in.
With organic products now coming from some of the nation's largest growers and processors, many early advocates have turned their attention to small, local farms. Then a story about a massive meat recall. Creation Gardens Incorporated of Louisville is recalling more than 22,000 pounds of raw ground beef and beef primal cuts that may be contaminated with E. coli. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service made the announcement this week after they were notified by plant management personnel of two positive test results for E. coli. Possibly contaminated beef was shipped to food service locations in Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee. The products were produced on May 31st through June 2nd. Check out the detailed product information on our website, eartheats.org. And people that live in rural areas are more connected to the internet than they've ever been. Roughly two-thirds of rural Americans have a broadband internet connection at home, according to data from the Pew Research Center. That's a much higher rate than just 10 years ago. But rural residents are still 10 percentage points less likely than urban Americans to have broadband access. The survey also finds that about 1 in 5 rural adults never use the internet, more than double the number of people in cities who say the same thing. The digital divide is present in adoption of certain technologies as well. While use and ownership of tablets and smartphones has been on the rise in rural areas, it too lags behind urban adoption of mobile technology. Adults in rural America are between 7 and 12 percentage points less likely than urban and suburban dwellers to own and use a smartphone, desktop computer, laptop, or tablet. States and the federal government have spent millions trying to incentivize internet companies to build more broadband infrastructure in rural areas. But in another Pew survey, only 36% of rural adults said the government should provide subsidies to help low-income Americans purchase high-speed home internet service. Go to our website to read more about these stories, and then share them on your Twitter and Facebook. We're at eartheats.org, and be sure to tag us.
Great. That's Mark Chilla. See you next week.
Okie doke.
A leading research center focused on growing crops without harming the environment is hanging on by a thread. Iowa has pulled state funding away from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports on what that means for a nationwide movement.
The Leopold Center's mission is to improve the environmental impact of agriculture in ways that still allow farmers to earn a living. For three decades, it has been housed at Iowa State University, and until recently, its funding came from the Iowa legislature.
I remember reviewing the Iowa law to get ideas on how to formulate the federal program.
Fred Hefner helped create the Federal Sustainable Ag Program. Now he's a senior advisor at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. He says the Leopold Center's leadership provided a model as several dozen additional states created similar groups. Its research has identified successful conservation practices, and it's been a pioneer in studying how local food systems can be successful.
That's a subject where Leopold did some of the early work that has now led to, you know, what's essentially an entire movement across the country.
The ubiquity of farmers markets, the creation of regional food hubs, the idea that you should know your farmer or buy fresh local produce all owe a little debt to the Leopold Center. Hefner finds it perplexing that the state legislature would forfeit that leadership role by no longer funding sustainable ag research.
It boggles the mind, really.
And yet, the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature passed two measures, one to defund the center and one to eliminate it altogether. Democratic State Senator Rita Hart farms with her husband in eastern Iowa and serves on the Agriculture Committee.
The justification was that the mission of the Leopold Center was complete. And as the pushback came on that explanation, it became clear that that just isn't the case.
Hart says, to the contrary, everyone involved with agriculture recognizes several ongoing vexing problems: preventing erosion, keeping nutrients in the soil, and improving water quality. These are all problems the Leopold Center's been working on, and solving them, she says, will benefit us all. Taking aim at the center seemed to further drive a wedge between rural and urban residents. And she says that's the wrong way to approach the problems.
Instead, we should be sitting down and solving these problems together in a logical, scientific kind of way. And that's why the efforts of the Leopold Center have been particularly helpful.
Ultimately, then-Governor Republican Terry Branstad, who signed the original law creating the Leopold Center, wielded his line item veto power to spare it. But the center will lose its state funding. Leopold Center Director Mark Rasmussen witnessed an outpouring of support for the research as the center's future waited on the governor's word.
I just would express some gratitude that he did agree to keep the center alive for another day.
The Leopold Center takes its name from the Iowa conservationist and writer Aldo Leopold. Each year, Ames residents inspired by Leopold's work gather to read it aloud.
It is on some but not all of these misty autumn daybreaks that one may hear a chorus of the quail. The silence is suddenly broken.
In a small crowd of mostly retirees, 8-year-old Amelia Todd is the final reader, with a passage from Leopold's A Sand County Almanac. The center's first director, Dennis Keeney, was there. He says Leopold's writings from the 1940s about the conflict between development and conservation, feeding the masses and respecting nature, continue to resonate today.
We'll spend more money, and by spending money, we'll make things better. Well, that hasn't ever worked, and Leopold says that.
Keeney says money's important, but it also matters who gets it. The funding that once fueled broad, diverse research at the Leopold Center will now flow to the Iowa Nutrient Research Center, which focuses exclusively on mitigating chemical runoff into waterways. The Leopold Center survives for now with a small pot of money from outside grants and endowment revenue. But it must go in search of other, more sustainable funding for the future. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
We've spoken with restaurateur Jeff Meese on Earth Eats a couple times, most recently about his business's Kitchen Share program that gives small food companies access to a professional kitchen. He's the CEO and co-founder of One World Enterprises that includes a catering company, a local pizza chain, a brewery, a sit-down restaurant, and a farm. Jeff has a passion for farming and animal husbandry. A couple years ago, I talked to him about a special relationship he had with one rather unusual animal. Come with us as we visit the place he calls Lush Farm. No matter how busy he is, Jeff Meese will always make time for one thing.
There you go, sweetie.
Mwah. What's her name?
Oh, this is Shadow.
Shadow's 9 weeks old, and she's an orphan.
What? How are you?
And she's a water buffalo. Do you think she knows her name?
I think it's getting there.
Jeff has 26 other Asian water buffalo. All of them shunned Shadow when she was born. So now she spends most of her time with humans and the farm dog, Louie.
She doesn't even know she's a buffalo, I think, by now.
So that we're all on the same page, these animals are not the humpbacked Great Plains American bison. Asian water buffalo pretty much look like cows with a striking set of horns. These horns can either coil like Raleigh Fingers' mustache or jut out like scythe blades. Shadow's horns at this point are just nubbins.
You want to do a little walking with us, you? Huh?
You can guess by the name that these Asian water buffalo are not native to Indiana. So why did it seem like a good idea to bring these animals to Midwestern America? First, you have to understand what motivates Jeff Meese: food and community. He's a very successful restaurateur. He owns Pizza X, a local pizza delivery chain, Lenny's Restaurant, and the Bloomington Brewing Company. For fun, he runs a farm.
You know, some people golf, some people love movies. I like to get out here and feel nature and grow stuff, give it away.
He grows hops for the brewery. His 80 tomato plants produce all the tomatoes for Lenny's.
You see, even Shadow likes tomatoes. She's been eating the plants. The plants are supposed to be poisonous. Don't eat too many of those.
He also had a vision to make his own cheese, this one specific kind of cheese, buffalo mozzarella. He first experienced it in Italy, where they milk the water buffalo, make the mozzarella, and sell it at the market all on the same day.
The mouthfeel and the flavor of it is just exquisite. You know, you would sit down and eat a baseball-sized chunk of this cheese and want more. After it's been refrigerated, then it's considered to have a much lower value and they use it on, like, pizza.
That was Jeff's grand plan. Buy 9 water buffalo with the intention of milking them for cheese. And then the problems started stacking up. As the herd grew in size, simply raising the animals took a lot of time. He realized his 70-acre plot of land was too small for the number of animals he would need. Not to mention constructing a creamery. That would have been quite an undertaking. So now what? He still wanted to produce something, but instead of cheese, what if the buffalo were the product?
I realize I can't do it all myself. And so I'm working on finding interested people.
He wants to transform his farm into a breeding operation so he can get water buffalo out into this part of the world. He envisions southern Indiana as a national hub for Asian water buffalo.
You know, if I've got to give them buffalo, that's what I'll do. But sort of almost find a few people that it's free to a good home.
2 of his bulls are headed to a farm in Vermont. Any takers locally? Not yet.
Come on, Shadow. Keep stepping, girl.
Jeff says everyone who meets Shadow falls in love with her a little bit, and I can vouch for that. Right now, she's adorably clumsy at just under 200 pounds. She'll grow to 8 times that size when all's said and done.
There she comes. So she runs up and butts you, which is going to be no good when you get bigger. So we're not sure just how we're going to deal with that.
He has 20 years to figure that out.
Oh, good girl.
Jeff makes it abundantly clear that Shadow is his favorite. because she's like family.
Oh, I think once you give him a name, yeah. She is like family.
He puts Shadow back in her pen. Until tomorrow. The story originally aired in 2014. See pictures of Shadow at eartheats.org. Coming up, Barbara Brozier's best banana cookies, a staff favorite around my office. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm Annie. This is Earth Eats. A group of cattle ranchers has spent years battling big meat companies. They say the companies have too much power and control too much of the market. But should the government be in charge of making sure meat companies play fair with farmers? Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on a move that has split the ranchers that raise our meat.
Nebraska calls itself the beef state, and that's thanks to places like Cumming County in the northeast part of the state. There are around 250,000 cattle on feedlots in this county alone, scattered among the corn and soybean fields. A few of those cattle belong to Steve Krychek.
This pen of cattle here is mine, brought in from Missouri a couple weeks ago.
We're at a feedlot near the town of West Point, where Krychek is an investor feeder. He buys young cattle and pays to feed them here. When they're grown, he sells them to the highest bidder, usually one of the big three meat packers in the beef business, JBS, Tyson, or Cargill. Although he says they often seem to be on the same page.
They all have the same price within 15 minutes of each other.
Only about a fourth of all cattle are sold on the open market like Krychek's. That means the vast majority of cattle are sold in a way where the price is usually not reported publicly. Krychek says without knowing what those cattle are worth, he's not sure when he's getting a good deal. It's like shopping for groceries with no price tags.
One guy could be getting $10 a hundred more than the other guy for the same cattle and the same genetics. And that is totally unfair. It looks like that's the direction we're headed.
Producers like Krychek are protected by law from unfair discrimination by meat packers. But recent court rulings have raised the legal standard. To succeed in court today, it's likely that Krychek would have to prove a meatpacking company is not just being unfair to him, but creating an unfair playing field for all independent cattle feeders.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Dudley Butler is an attorney in Mississippi. Early in the Obama administration, he was in charge of the agency of the Agriculture Department that handles complaints like Krychek's.
It's just not realistic to think that one rancher gets cheated on his price on some cattle, and you have to show that that affects the whole industry.
What Butler is worried about is known as vertical integration, when a company controls all stages of production, from breeding cattle to fattening them up to selling them at your grocery store. That makes big companies powerful enough to shape the market in their favor.
If we don't get some type of regulations or rules, everything is going to move towards vertical integration, as in the poultry industry and pretty much in the pork industry now.
When he was in Washington, Butler helped write a rule that makes it easier for a rancher to bring a complaint. The producer wouldn't have to prove there's a meat monopoly, only that they were treated unfairly. Years later, that rule was finally issued in the last days of the Obama White House. But shortly after taking office, the Trump administration put it on hold. And some in the beef industry would be happy to see it scrapped altogether.
We don't need the government's involvement telling us how to market our product.
Craig Uden runs a feedlot in central Nebraska and is the current president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Meat companies say working directly with producers has pushed ranchers to raise better cattle and, in turn, sell more meat. Uden agrees. Most of his cattle are not sold on the open market. They're sold directly to a meat packer, some branded as certified Angus. Producers already have a fair choice, Uden says. They can stay in the regular market or sign up with one of those programs.
If I didn't have the processors, how am I going to market my cattle? I've got options, but I try to fit into the program, and I want to add value to my livestock all the way through.
Dudley Butler, the ex-regulator, says it's good for producers to find security by developing a niche, but he says the beef industry is really the last one to have an open market for independent producers, even if it is a fraction of what it once was.
You just pick away at the marketplace, and once you pick away at it enough, it's, as we say down south, it's death by duck bite, where the marketplace just fades away.
The Trump administration has until October to repeal the rule, change it, or let it take effect. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
More stories and videos at harvestpublicmedia.org. I went over to Barbara Brozier's house at 7 o'clock one Tuesday evening. I was in some kick-around clothes and sneakers, but she was still dressed from work that day. I knew this because we work together. At WFIU, she's the senior news editor.
Hi.
Oh, come on in.
Thanks.
I'm nervous. I don't know why.
Have you ever been on this other side of it?
I don't think I have.
Really?
Yeah.
Barbara also writes the blog The Broadcasting Baker. She posts recipes not just for baked goods. Like, the latest recipe is for grilled chicken and herbs she's growing in her new garden. She also likes to write about her and her husband James's adventures in craft beer, and there are some DIY projects on there.
We should also talk about the fact that you are that person in our office that bakes stuff for people, like birthday cookies, like just great stuff on a Wednesday. Oh my gosh, what did she bring in? Why do you do that? Why do you do that for us?
I think that's it. Especially, I mean, our jobs are crazy, and especially news. It's a thankless business. You're expected in so many jobs anymore to do so much with less, and you do it a lot of times at the expense sometimes of your own sanity. And so I think it's great to tell, you know, your colleagues and your team members, tell them thank you sometimes. So this is a recipe for banana cookies that I have no idea where my mother got it, but it's something she made a lot growing up. My husband, James, it was like his most requested recipe after we started dating, as he always wanted banana cookies, so.
Awesome. Okay, go for it.
Go for it? Okay.
She's got the dry ingredients, flour, baking powder, and soda, salt, cloves, and cinnamon.
All right, so we're gonna whisk together the dry ingredients, which is pretty easy. You can smell it, the cinnamon.
Oh, yeah.
I love that smell.
Set that aside, then she creams the butter and sugar in her stand mixer.
But see, it's really fluffy and it almost kind of comes together. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm gonna mash these bananas. And I actually usually buy extra bananas every week so that we'll have some brown bananas for either banana bread or these cookies or smoothies. And if I don't have any plans for them immediately, I just throw them in the freezer and either throw them frozen in smoothies or thaw them out when I want to make something else. And I love actually the moisture the bananas lend to everything. I made a couple weeks ago, I had a ton of brown bananas, and so I made these blonde brownies with bananas in them, and they were awesome. All right, so we're gonna put that in here.
In go the bananas, mixed up with the other wet ingredients. Then she adds the dry ingredients and slowly brings the batter together. She lines a cookie sheet with a piece of parchment paper. Using a standard cookie scoop, she portions out a dozen little dough balls.
And I'm a big believer. It's great if things look pretty, but it's the the effort that goes into baking that I think a lot of people appreciate. I'm gonna stick these in the oven. And they will just barely get a little golden. You don't want to, this is kind of a cakey cookie, so you don't want to overdo it at all.
Bake them for 10 minutes, check, and then maybe tack on another 2 minutes. Now's the time when she blends up the frosting, powdered sugar, mashed bananas, butter, and vanilla. That's it. When that's done, she starts the cleanup. Her hands are always busy doing something. And it's been that way since college, when she started baking regularly in her free time.
I've always just really thrived on being crazy busy. I have to have insane deadlines, like, for all things in my life. And I think, I do think maybe I turned to it for the same reasons. I wanted something. I couldn't just go home and watch TV for hours. And I was great about doing my homework. But once that was done, I just can't sit idle. And so I think I just turned to baking.
She was the person in college who made big Sunday dinners for all her friends. She studied journalism while also being involved with the student TV station and the student newspaper. Her first idea for a career path was to be a professional food writer for Cooking Light, which she'd been a fan of since she was a kid. Then toward the end of college, she filled out some online applications for culinary school. But in the end, she chose the newsroom.
I love what I do, but it is very hectic sometimes. And so to be able to come home and pull out a familiar recipe for me is just like a huge sigh of relief. I mean, to be honest, most nights I probably don't kind of like sit down until maybe 8:30 or 9. That's how I like it. I do not do well with relaxing. I try to, and sometimes I know I need to get better at that, but I don't. I just go, go, go. That's how I've always been. See how it's just barely golden brown, and you can kind of see that at eye level,
yeah,
too. Barely.
Very tips.
Yes.
She slathers on the banana frosting and puts them in a container to take to work the next day. She hasn't completely written off food as a pie-in-the-sky career. Slinging these banana cookies at the farmer's market sounds pretty good to her some days. Thanks so much to Barbara Brozier, senior news editor at WFIU. Her blog is thebroadcastingbaker.com. She inspired us this week to post lots and lots of banana-based recipes on the website. There are these cookies and her chocolate banana blondies. You'll see a few different recipes for banana bread. I've put all the recipes in a list on the new podcast post at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Eabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University's Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Thanks for listening, friends. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next time.